Hey guys, and welcome to the Money Podcast. Today we're going to talk about your job, specifically if you're going to have one soon, or if you're going to be replaced by artificial intelligence or a robot. We're going to tell you what you need to know, answer your questions, and give you some tips that are going to make you smarter and hopefully richer. And we're going to do it without boring you to death in the process. I'm your host, Stacy Johnson. I'm here with my co-host, Miranda Marquette. Listening in and occasionally chiming in is producer Aaron Freeman. And today we have a very special guest, Professor Anthony P. Carnevale, director of Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. Let's get the ball rolling right away, guys. Technological progress, obviously nothing new. It's been happening since we came out of caves. And from the Industrial Revolution to the Internet, progress has always created more jobs than it's destroyed. That's so far. But some are now arguing that this time might be different. We all know that robots have already taken a lot of manufacturing jobs. Factories that used to have 6,000 workers now have 600. But now it's getting worse. Now management and other white-collar jobs are in danger too, thanks to artificial intelligence. So here's my first question, Dr. Carnevale. What if robots and AI take more jobs than they make? What then?
Well, I think the real answer to this question, and it's supported pretty massively by the data, is that as far as we know, this time won't be different. That is, that's the basic argument among for those who say AI is going to take away everybody's job, that technology hasn't done that so far. Essentially the same technology since about 1983, the computer and all of its children have had massive impact on skills in the American economy and probably took away 8%, 9% of the jobs since 1980. But what happens with technology is it doesn't so much take away the whole job. It ends up changing the tasks in the job. That is, the technology takes on more of the individual tasks and more of the individual routines in the case of AI. But it elevates the skill requirement and increases output in the economy on the whole. So just for example, we started out with roughly 105 million jobs in 1979, which was when the technology boom happened after the 80-81 recession. That's when Bill Gates and the computer arrived on the scene. And since that time, we've gone from 100 or so million jobs to 150 million jobs in the American economy. So technology certainly didn't reduce the number of jobs. And over that period, what happened was there was a massive skill shift. In the 70s, 70% of the good jobs could be had with just high school, but now it's almost that number. It's more like 65% tend to require some education and training after high school. So the effect of technology has been to create jobs and to change the tasks in jobs. And yes, in some cases, it has actually eliminated jobs, especially in manufacturing. So looking forward, we see, and it's not, I suppose it is technology. COVID is probably the issue at the moment because we all learned to stay home. And I can tell you, my little operation at Georgetown University, we're not going back to the office because we're saving $200,000 a year by staying home. So, I mean, there will be shifts that are technology related. And that one is one that's quite sudden, I think. We're not clear how powerful it will be, but I think most of us agree it will be a loss of office space. And then secondly, we know that retail has been being taken over since Amazon arrived on the scene, and that will continue. So retail is in trouble, and that is technology related.
You know, we're going to get into the definition of AI, but I want to, before we do that, I want to present a counter argument. And I'm sure you're familiar with Martin Ford, Rise of the Robots, he wrote.
Yeah.
So anyway, here's a quote from him. Now, it has always been true, or rather, what has been true is that more education, we know that robots are taking over manual labor. More education, though, is going to enable us to keep our place in the workforce. Here's a quote from his latest book. We're running up against a fundamental limit, both in terms of the capabilities of the people being herded into colleges and the number of high school jobs that will be available for them if they manage to graduate. The problem is that the skill ladder is not really a ladder at all. It's a pyramid, and there's only so much room at the top. The point being, I guess what he's trying to say is, because of AI, more jobs are going to be taken over by computers than was possible. It's going to be a paradigm shift. So there's going to be fewer opportunities for people, even with high skills. Agree, disagree?
He has an argument, but his argument is this time it'll be different. I mean,
yes.
When I was a young man, I always thought that about my next relationship, and it never was. But in the end, that's the argument for people like him, is that this has never happened before. It has been predicted constantly since Ned Ludd and the Luddites in the 1700s, but it's never happened. So they may be right. I mean, maybe this time it's different, but we have no data that demonstrates that. And when we project job growth out 10 years, which is a little muddled at the moment because of COVID, we see growth from, let's say, the bottom of the COVID recession. We were at about 140 million jobs. And that by 2030, most macro estimates are that we'll be at 168 million jobs. The largest growth in jobs will come for people with bachelor's degrees and graduate degrees, although they'll be substantial. They'll be about 40% of the jobs, but a good 30% will go to people who have less than a BA, but more than a high school degree, maybe a two-year degree or certificate. And then there will be a good 20% of the jobs that will be high school jobs, but they won't pay very much and they won't have benefits.
Well, I like your logic because I'm an investment guy, Dr. Carnevale, and I've been doing this for 40 years, investing in the stock market. And every now and then, including right now, as a matter of fact, people say this time it's different. This time the economy is different. This time PE ratios don't matter, like what's going on right now. And you know what? They're always wrong because it's never different. And so I respect and admire your argument that if there's no evidence that it's going to be different, why should we assume that it is? Fair enough.
And you got to remember that this is not when I graduated from graduate school. I went to work for the Nixon administration. I'm not sure I should admit that, but I did. I was part of a group of young economists who persuaded the president to support Richard Nixon, the Republican, support a guaranteed annual income for all Americans. The reason he did that was he thought, and we all thought, that technology was going to take away all the jobs. This issue comes up over and over and over again. And so far, it just hasn't lived up to the hype.
I'm surprised we haven't met because when you were working in the Nixon administration, I was in college protesting the Nixon administration.
I wasn't even born yet.
Well, so before I worked for the Nixon administration, I was suing the Nixon administration. It's how I ended up working for them.
Oh, cool. Now, see, nice. Now we're friends again. and just so you know, Miranda and Aaron, their parents hadn't met yet when you and I were
actually, yes, that's true. My parents hadn't met yet.
Let's back up a step real quick. And for those, because we have all different kinds of skill levels listening to our podcast. What is AI? Can you explain it so we can understand it?
Well, AI is there are lots of sort of mystical, near religious kinds of definitions of AI, but basically it's the ability of technology to take on routines, that is, sets of tasks as against tasks. Now, that's been happening since the 80s. And AI has gradually taken on whole sets of tasks. Why, back in the day, in the 70s, the core floor team in manufacturing, the people who really did the work, was about five people, and they were a couple of them were laborers, a couple of them were skilled tradespeople, machine operators, and so on. Now that team is one person. That is, we've lost four out of five of those jobs. That one person is much more highly skilled, and in combination with the technology that took on all of the functions of those four other people, that person is much more productive. So we lost those jobs, and then there was a shift away from those jobs. And so the middle skill jobs are now what we used to think of as blue collar jobs are now healthcare, for example, and computers, for example. But all of those require some kind of post high school certification training, and that's going to be more and more true.
That makes total sense. Now, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, you, Dr. Carnevale, or anyone, either of the other two guys too, my understanding of AI is simply that because of the amount of computer power that we have available to us right now, these a computer can test 10,000 different scenarios, decide which one is best, and proceed in that direction. Just simply because of the power of the computer and the amount of data that it has available, it can start making decisions, not like a human being, but way closer to a human being than was possible before. Is that basically what you guys understand AI to be?
Yeah, and it's what the computer, little AI, has done in the economy in general. Got to remember that in the United States between 1946 and, depending on how you count, maybe 1973, when the Germans and the Japanese finally dug out of the rubble and came after us and were very successful. We basically were the world's dominant economy because we were the very best at producing standardized goods and services at very low prices. Well, what technology has done is it's taken away that model so that instead of cheap standardized goods and services, the technology has allowed us to improve quality, variety with a few keystrokes. It's forced us all to go to work for the people we buy. We all work for Amazon. We're all spending time on our machine, helping them make money. And customization, convenience, novelty. So the computer, in the end, in combination with a lot of organizational changes that came along with it, have resulted in much higher value in products and services. And it's precisely for that reason that human beings with higher skill levels are required to mobilize that capability, to exploit the technology.
Okay. But I think a lot of, certainly what most anyone listening to this podcast can understand and wrap their mind around is the fact that we have so fewer people on the factory floor than we used to because of robots, you know, because of robotics. I was staying in a hotel last summer, or about a year ago, actually, in Napa Valley. And if you wanted a towel or an extra pillow or even some wine, a robot brought it to your room. It would literally ring your doorbell, and it was called Rosé because it was Napa Valley. And it would bring stuff to your room, and people were calling stuff to get stuff to the room just to watch this robot walk down the hall. Now, obviously, this is a simple example, but you could, you know, GM plants that used to employ thousands of workers now employ hundreds because there's so many robots doing their job. I think everybody wraps their mind around that, but I think what people don't wrap their mind around yet, or at least not all people, is the number of jobs that we used to call white collar jobs that are going to disappear. Like customer service. We've all experienced that. AI is now enabling a robot or whatever, a disembodied voice, to talk to us as if it's a person. Actually, even programming, writing programs, is now being done by artificial intelligence. In fact, I own a website. There's now artificial intelligence that will write articles. So there are things that are way beyond Rosé carrying a towel to my room. There are white-collar jobs that are going to go away and stay away. There's advertising jobs, pharmaceutical jobs, research jobs, banking. Look at banking. Retail checkout. How about that? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's going on. Obviously, you know, fast food service, long-haul trucking. This is something that might go away. And in fact, I read something in Forbes the other day. Any task that can be learned by a computer because of artificial intelligence. Any task that can be learned. Now, that does sound like it could be a paradigm shift that's dangerous, that's scary.
Well, one thing that I read is that right now with AI, you're looking at something that's very logical in its pattern, and we create that logic pattern by the coding. And the one thing that separates us right now is lateral thinking.
Yeah.
And they're pretty much sure that by 2050, we'll have AI that has lateral thinking. And at that point, we humans become irrelevant and possibly surpassed.
But now,
Stacy's going to find a robot to write articles for me, isn't he?
Yes, Miranda's a writer on my website.
I'm going
yes,
to be replaced. I'm going to be replaced by.
I will drop you like a hot rock, Miranda. Absolutely. Let me do this real quick. I want to come back and get your response to what I just said, Dr. Cannavale, but I have to take a minute here to pay the bills because I don't have a robot to introduce this commercial. I'm going to do it myself. Hold on, guys. We're halfway through our show. Time to pay a bill or two. We'll be right back after this quick break. Okay, we are back. Dr. Cannavale, you just heard me tell a whole bunch of jobs and why today may be different because computers have the knowledge to take over a lot of white-collar jobs that historically were totally safe. How do you respond to that?
Well, there's a crucial connection here. That is, whatever the robot does, it's going to create value. Someone is going to own the robot. Someone is going to make money out of that, and there'll be lots of other people exploiting that capability. Now, we've never run up against a situation otherwise. I guess that's the ultimate answer. And when we look at industry going forward, at least 10 years out, which we can do pretty accurately with technology assumptions in the model, we see nothing but growth. Now, the growth is constrained. That is, the growth tends to shift towards higher skilled workers because it takes more highly skilled workers and consumers, by the way, to actually exploit the technology and use it effectively. You got to remember that an economy is people, in a capitalist economy, is people making money and passing it around to each other. And until the human appetite for quality, variety, whatever, novelty, whatever is next ends, there will be people who will be producing services mostly, because that's what we've shifted to. Manufacturing has become a simple parlor trick. You can do it anywhere in the world, and that's part of the reason we lost a lot of these jobs, not just technology. A lot of it went overseas, where people would accept lower wages to do something that was pretty easy, truthfully, with the help of technology. So I just don't, in the end, one of the things that's always striking to me, because this issue has been around forever, is the fear people have about this. And that is apparently, and I suppose there's good reason for that, especially in the news, the most terrifying thing in the world is taking jobs and churches away from people, because then God knows what they'll do. So there is this underlying fear that's interesting. It goes back to, I think the truth of it is that human beings are inherently workers. We're inherently makers of things makers of services. And the idea that we would no longer be makers of things and deliverers of services threatens us because we believe it is takes away a basic human urge. And I think that's probably true. So I don't think the technologists are right. They can't prove they're right. They can talk about it, but they've been talking about it for 300 years. And so far it hasn't happened.
But you would have to concede that there could be major upheaval. If my job, one of my jobs is running my website. And what I mean by that is I have to decide what people are going to be interested in. I have to publish articles people are going to click on. Now, Miranda writes those articles, but I have to decide what kind of articles we should be writing in the big sense of things. Now, it's easy to imagine that an algorithm may ultimately be able to know what my audience is, what they crave more than I do. I'm just going by the seat of my pants and by my 30, 40 years of experience. But an algorithm may be able to do my job better than me. An algorithm or AI may be able to write an article better than Miranda. And when those things occur, well, I won't be out of a job until I'm still on the website. But what if we're out of a job? I mean, that's upheaval. It may be that there's another job out there for us, but we still don't have a job right now.
Right. We can't all become owners.
Right. I mean, so where's
anybody on this podcast can build a semiconductor? Can any of you guys build an LCD panel?
As a matter of fact, I mean,
technology has gone way past us, and there's a very few that understand these things. There's very few people who can actually write in binary code.
But Dr. Cannavale, what are Miranda and Aaron and I, or even you? I mean, it's possible that AI could replace at least you being in the classroom. obviously it can't replace, you know, the random thoughts and the research that you do, but it may be able to teach better than you. I mean, it may have access to more resources, and it may have better access to better, you know, teaching techniques. It didn't have an argument with a spouse when it left the house this morning, so maybe it's a better teacher than you. I mean, what if ultimately all of us could lose the jobs that we now have? Isn't that upheaval? Isn't it scary?
Well, then what you get is the Star Trek economy, in which people only, you know, go out and explore other worlds and, you know, do grandiose. They only do work that they want to do, and many of them don't work at all. In the end, that is the humanity's oldest dream, is to be free of work, free of labor. Turns out that it harms us greatly when we become free of labor, and that's true. This has always been happening. Every 80 to 100 years, you basically change. Half the jobs are gone, is one rough estimate that I think would probably hold up. But over time, there's a shift. And there's a shift in demand and a shift in supply. And the more technology can produce, the more wealth we have. The more wealth we have, the more we spend it for increasingly not goods, but services, because goods are relatively cheap now. Services is what costs money.
But even if you, and I certainly agree with what you just said, how can you not? But that you're taking if you're looking at the macro. Yeah, we're not going to make buggy whips anymore, but we're going to make tires for new automobiles. You know, I mean, I get that shift, and it's all well and good unless you're the person working in the buggy whip factory. So let me ask you this question. What should today's worker do to prepare? After all, that's what this podcast is about. It's helping people make and save and create wealth. So if we've now defined what could be at the minimum a shift, at the maximum an upheaval, what should today's worker do to prepare for what's ahead?
Well, I can tell you, as a former political director for the AFL-CIO, what they should do, and that is they should get a union, for starters, so that they can bargain with capital management to ensure that the change process in the workplace does the least harm. And if they can't get a union, they need to get a government that will do that, and that's what's gradually happening. And if you look toward the role, the increasing role, of the federal government in look at this pandemic. In the end, the government has become the union of last resort for most Americans. That's what that stimulus package was about. So I think what workers can do, because workers have been struggling against the power of technology and the power of capital, not just technology, but the power of capital and technology for a couple hundred years. It's never really taken hold in America the way it did elsewhere. In Europe, there was so much angst about this prior to World War II that in the end, it was real fascists, real communists that took over the governments and destroyed the planet. So people in Europe are afraid of workers. Americans have only learned to be afraid of workers lately because of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that because there's a whole different conversation about the politics and the inequality, you know, behind these trends. But here's another question though: who's responsible for dealing with the retraining of the worker? You're a truck driver, and you know, or at least we can guess that perhaps one day, not tomorrow, the next day, but 10 years, 15, 20 years from now, that truck's going to drive itself. So you see something happening. Is it your responsibility as that truck driver to re-educate yourself in a different direction or to get more education? Or is it the government's responsibility? Or is it both?
It's, in the end, it's good government, but it's bad politics. The truth is, the way the economy works is you go to school, however long, you get a job, you learn stuff on the job. The value of what you learn on the job far exceeds. The school may have put you into a particular job, but the value you get from work experience and the technology you work with that's where your money comes from. If you lose that job, especially let's say you're over the age of 35, there is no good news in that. People try to make it good news, but that's a lie. In the end, people who lose their jobs use all the capital they created working for a particular employer. Now, it's okay if you lose your job at GM and you get a job at Ford, okay. You'll be okay if you keep your occupation. But if you lose your occupation, you're in deep trouble. You're going to lose at least 40% of your earnings. And all the programs we've built in the government, and we did a lot of this years ago, and we're about to do more of it again, all the programs we built in government have not succeeded in restoring workers to their prior position, except in maybe 25% of the case, and they tended to be younger workers. So job loss is tragedy. There's no doubt about it. It's a deeper tragedy than I think most of us realize. And in the end, governments, I can tell you as somebody involved in politics, that you do never stand up in front of a group of working Americans and say, I'm going to fix your life. I'm going to give you job training, because what they hear you saying is you're going to get fired. Mm-hmm. And what they want you to hear you say is, I'm going to give you a job, which is what Trump did.
Yeah, but it didn't work.
Well, he didn't really deliver. It might have worked if he'd have tried, but he didn't.
Well, I think there's some governments, like in Finland, they do things like this, where the government knows these things are happening, and they offer education to everybody to retrain them into
That's true. I read the same thing about Switzerland, or Sweden. I'm sorry, Sweden.
The European countries, not all of them, but the ones we'd all name, beginning with Germany back in the old days, for obvious reasons, they were scared to death of the working class. But the European countries spend anywhere between 2 and 4% of their GDP on what are called active labor market policies, which include maintaining your job security, by the way. And in the end, the United States, including unemployment insurance, spends less than one half of 1%. We've never built out this system that presupposes what's happened since the 80s, which is job security is way down. And the way you make your way if you're young in the labor market is you keep changing jobs. It's nonsense about being loyal to employers. The millennials have figured that out. That's why we all find them so annoying. they know what they're up against. So I think, no, we don't do that here. There are very conservative people now, friends of mine, who are saying, if we're going to save capitalism, we're going to have to build out active labor market policy, because we now got a constituency of voters who are willing to stop a trade bill. And that's a big deal in American political history, because trade kills jobs.
The central theme of this podcast to me is that the upheaval that's always gone on as technology progresses, the people who became unemployed, you know, when factories used steam engines, horses became, you know, people who ran horses became unemployed, blah, blah, blah. This is an onward progression, and it will continue. But I think it's being exacerbated by the progress of AI and robotics, and it exacerbated to the point where it may become societal upheaval. You're saying no. I'm saying I have no clue. You know, it doesn't matter. But I do know one thing. Life is going to change. And people who are not prepared for that are going to be in bad shape.
I think running out of coffee, chocolate, and water actually will cause societal upheaval. But
yeah.
I read this interesting white paper about quantitative waves and stuff like that. And in his article, they're saying that the next technologies to answer that question, like, okay, what do we invest in, and what jobs should we be doing? They were saying environmental technologies, biotechnology, nanotechnology, and healthcare are the next wave to get into. Is that true?
I would agree on healthcare, not so much on the others. That is, you have to be careful with employment projections and data, that you look at the volume of jobs, not the rate of increase, which is what people do all the time. There's not a reporter I know of in this domain who doesn't write the article about this brand new job that nobody ever heard of before.
So even with climate change that we got going on, you don't think environmental technology is the next big thing?
We did a One would hope so, yes. But back when the Obama administration, green jobs, we actually did a study for the government and we couldn't find any, by the way. We didn't publish the study. In the end, what greening appears to do to the economy, at least so far, I mean, it could, you don't know, it could be a next huge source of job growth. And a lot of people believe that. Their numbers are not very good, incidentally. But the green jobs, in the end, what they did was it changed tasks and activities in all sorts of jobs. If you were a plumber, you got greened. There are a whole set of skills you need now that you didn't need before we started becoming worried about water quality, pressure, a whole series of things. So a lot of workers were affected by the greening of America, which has been going on slowly. And so far, the job creation side of it is not very strong. The study we did, I mean, the joke at the end of the study among us was that, we created a technician for every blade on every windmill in America. And there just weren't that many jobs.
Yeah. And by the way, Dr. Carnevale, too, and I would suggest to any listener here, you did some really great work I just read the other day. I have it right here. The Economic Value of College Majors, which was a super cool thing. Like it says, STEM jobs can expect to make $43,000 a year. I don't know how old this survey is or this research is. Health was 41,000, business 37, career focus 30 grand, and arts, humanities, and liberal arts 29. That's just the executive summary. It's quite an extensive bit of research. But I would recommend that to anybody who's heading toward getting a bachelor's degree, if indeed making money is one of your goals. Nice work.
One of the things that's happened in the economy that is different that people still haven't completely absorbed, although on the policy side it's well understood and there's momentum to do something about it, and that is that what happened after 1983, after the 81 recession, when the technology boom occurred, what happened was that the value of post-secondary, post-high school education and training doubled relative to the value of a high school education. But the thing that people don't talk about, so that's a great ad for any college, go to college. But what people don't talk about nearly as much is that the value of fields of study, majors, what you take determines what you make. What's changed dramatically in the relationship between education and the economy is that value is now about the program you took, not the institution you went to.
Very cool. And we're going to have a link to that study too, in our show notes for people who want to see that, because it is really interesting. And if you're like me, you can read the executive summary and pretend like you read the whole research paper. So, but it is cool. And it's got charts and graphs too. So you don't even have to read. You can just, it's like comics at the beginning. So take a look at it. Miranda, we haven't heard much from you. Do you have any questions for Dr. Cannavale before we call it a day?
No.
She's sitting there worried about her next job.
I'm just, trying to figure out who I need to go hang out with, who's not gonna fire me for a robot in the next.
I would never fire you for a robot until a robot can sound like you on a podcast, then you're in trouble. So what, by the way, before we leave though, what about universal basic income, Dr. Carnevale? A pipe dream never occurs, might happen. What do you think?
I don't know. Just as, I mean, let me be clear. I don't know. The only honest answer to what's going to happen in the future is, first of all, I don't know. And then the other answer, the not so honest answer, but people like me do it for a living, is it all depends. So in the end, one could suppose, let's suppose we do get an economy where there are very few workers, and but those workers will be producing enormous amounts of wealth. Then the issue gets to be how you distribute the wealth. Changes the society entirely. Then the government's role, I assume, is to take the money and divvy it up.
Yeah, through taxation, right? I mean, I
Well,
guess.
I don't know how else you do this. It's the If you know you've got 100 workers and only 20 of them end up working, but they're creating, and they will be if they're working with the kind of technology we're talking about, they'll be creating enormous wealth and productive capability. Well, who gets the stuff and who gets the money? You got to find a way to distribute it if people can't work to buy it, right? So suddenly work comes out of the equation, and there has to be some sort of a compact in the society, one that we're struggling with now, as opposed to the Europeans, I would argue, which is, you know, you got to let, my bias is let technology do its thing. It benefits all of us greatly, and it hurts some of us horribly. So you got to compensate the losers. It's that simple. That's what the Europeans do.
Yeah.
So in the end, we may have a society where it will be the Star Trek economy. And this thing that scares people is, what do you do if you don't work?
I'm going to find out pretty soon. Actually, I don't right? think, I mean, honestly, I don't know what I would do if I didn't work. I actually have no idea what to do.
It reminds me of an episode of Black Mirror. Anybody seen that on, I think it's Netflix. And there was a society where, you know, obviously AI is taken over and everything's done for us. So people, their value, they created a value system based on your social likeness on online. So if you're, the more likes you have and the more people like you in your social network, the more you got paid. So that was your value.
You're so far out there sometimes, Aaron.
No, that's he's talking about the dating market right there.
Right.
That's true. Oh, no, one more thing, and then we do have to go. Were you going to say something, Miranda?
No, I was just going to say, I think the key is trying to figure out what you can do that's meaningful. And when you look at like the FIRE movement, the financial independence, retire early crowd, a lot of them, you know, once they hit that number, their number, once they get to that point where they're financially independent and they don't have to work, it becomes about finding something meaningful to do. So not necessarily creating work or value for somebody else, but more about creating value in their own lives and saying, okay, well, volunteer work, you know, go run for office, you know, raise my kids, whatever it is. They try and find something meaningful they can do, even if it's not producing labor for somebody else.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I always thought that the FIRE movement was just a load of crap, because what's ironic about the FIRE movement is that the people promoting the FIRE movement have retired early, but they're not retired because they're promoting the FIRE movement with websites. I mean, it's just ridiculous. All it really is is finding a job you want to do instead of something you have to do. That's all it is. And that's right, what it should be. And that's what we've always tried to do. The FIRE movement didn't invent that.
Right. Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I've been doing that our whole lives.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. I'm just saying, like, that's the point, right? You got to, as humans, we like to have something purposeful and meaningful to do.
Yes.
And so if we're not going to be doing work for somebody else, we want to be doing something with purpose and meaning.
There's clearly going to be an increase in oil painters.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to even cash my universal basic income check. I'm going to be out there working, you guys. Okay, so here's one last question.
Well, you know, the way Social Security works, because I'm doing it, is you can get your universal basic income. That's what Social Security is.
Yeah, you're right.
And you can still work and make money on top of that, by the way.
One last question, and then I'm done. Dr. Carnevale, you're smarter than me. How are you investing in recognition of the trends we've been discussing today? And I know you're a .edu guy, and you don't like to talk about money, but this is a money podcast. I want to know how you are investing, if you are, in recognition of the trends we've discussed today.
Well, the investment portfolios show pretty well that you invest in technology-related stocks. I mean, that is, we have a whole index for that. That's been a winner, generally speaking, apart from the dot-com bubble burst and so on. It can get you into trouble because, you know, basically the stock market's a mood ring. And if everybody suddenly thinks tomorrow there's going to be no jobs and all technology, I can assure you we'll get a stock market crash. But I think the answer is that a lot of where the growth is where technology has connected to people, that is the Amazons, the computer markets, all the ones we know since the 80s.
Google, Microsoft.
Yep.
Me too.
And one wonders, there are people who argue, serious economists who argue that that is running out of steam. I don't see that in the markets, but there are people who are saying that the combination of the technology and the participation of the customer, that we're running out of range there. I think AI may be the thing that brings the customer in more to the actual creation of the service and the delivery of the service. It's kind of what has gone on with Google and Amazon and so on, is we're all working together. Yeah. And we work for free. We give them money so we can go online and take our time to buy their stuff.
Yep. When you can't beat them, buy them. That's what I say. And by the way, that was a great .edu answer to a specific question about how you invest your money. But nonetheless, I'm afraid we're out of time, guys, but we're never out of this topic. So dig deeper. You're going to find links to lots more info in our show notes. And tune in next time. We're going to be talking about low-risk ways to earn more on your savings. And remember, if your goal is to make more, to spend less, to retire rich, your online home is MoneyTalksNews.com. And don't forget to check out Miranda's online home as well. That is Miranda Marquit, MARQUIT.com. And visit Dr. Cannavale at the Georgetown University Center on Education and Workforce. You're going to find a link to that in our show notes. Lots of cool stuff there. Check it out. If you got a question, comment, or topic you'd like to suggest, tell me about it. Email us at hello@MoneyTalksNews.com. That's hello@MoneyTalksNews.com. And one last thing, if you appreciate what we do, do something for us. Subscribe to our podcast. Takes you 2 seconds. Really helps us out. So if you like us, show us and subscribe. I'm Stacy Johnson.
And I'm Miranda Marquit.
And I'm Aaron Freeman.
And thanks again, Dr. Anthony Cannavale. Thanks for hanging out with us, guys. We're going to see you right here next time.